Mogcast, a fortnightly conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg about the topics of the day. Welcome to the 84th Mogcast. This is Paul Goodman, editor of Conservative Home, in conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg. Jacob, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming around.
And this is our final discussion about Brexit, which obviously has been much in the news and comment, given the anniversary of leaving. I thought I'd approach it in a somewhat unusual way by challenging some of the usual premises of the discussion. Because I think when Brexit is discussed and reviewed, some unconscious assumptions are sometimes made. One of them is that the EU itself hasn't changed in the period between the referendum and today, and that had we not decided to leave, we'd be with the EU as it was in 2016. That's the first assumption. I think the second assumption is that had the referendum swung in favour of Remain, the whole business would somehow have been settled. And we would continue along a happy path, so the Remain diehards would argue, within the EU. And again, that's an assumption I want to discuss. So let's go to the first and think about the EU as it is now compared to the EU in 2016. So a refrain of Eurosceptics and Leavers has always been the EU's goal is ever closer union. It's always moving towards ever closer union. To what degree is that really true? What's the evidence for that claim having been affected between 2016 and now?
Well, I think I saw a figure recently that there were 7,300 or so new regulations that had come in from the EU in the period since we'd left. So to the extent that regulation is symbolic of ever closer union because it's ensuring that everybody operates on the same basis, that has been happening. Ever closer union also involves foreign policy and defence policy. Now, there have been the continued discussions, the continued desires to move to a closer integration of defence, which has perhaps been brought into sharper contrast by events in Ukraine, making the EU feel that it needed more of a united defence pattern. Though it's worked in two ways, hasn't it? Because Europe is quite split on how it should respond to Ukraine, with Germany being very nervous about doing anything and other states being keener to act faster. But nonetheless, that pressure is there, and that is true also of the foreign policy. And it's true in their response to COVID economically, where there's been a 2 trillion euro scheme for the rebuilding of economies post-COVID. Now, you may think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we've done that for ourselves domestically. We took the costs of COVID to our domestic economy. This is £191 billion, had we still been in the European Union, that we would have had a liability for.
Of course, on the one hand, you can argue that we will not receive any of the benefit of debt pooling. On the other, had we been in this scheme, you can imagine the noise from the Eurosceptic press and elsewhere about being on the hook for the debt of other countries.
That's absolutely right. And this is fundamental. If you look at the United States, how does that develop? What creates the push for a single country rather than the 13 individual states? It's the debt pooling. And Alexander Hamilton is determined to make sure the debt pooling takes place because he realizes that once that's happened, then you have the creation of an individual state. And it's also a major incentive for the heavily indebted member states to join in. So you overcome some of the opposition to a single state through debt pooling. So with the 2 trillion euros, they are following a pattern that the United States of America first used at the end of the 18th century.
So, all right, we're agreed that whether you think Brexit was a good thing or a bad thing, I think we all ought to be able to agree that the EU has changed, probably not as dramatically as it did during the Delors period in the 1980s, probably the biggest leap in the European project of all, but it has changed in the last 6 or 7 years or so. But let's go on to think about something else. So let's just suppose for a moment the referendum had been won by Remain. Now, let's assume it wouldn't have won by very much, that it's 52-48 the other way round. So first of all, there's a kerfuffle in some quarters about the legitimacy of the referendum, isn't there? As there was a flap on the day, if I remember rightly, from some Leave quarters about the fact that the voting was done in pencil. Now, I didn't take that all that seriously, for better or worse, but you can bet that other people would in the event of a close referendum, would they not?
Conspiracy theories get going at the drop of a hat, and you're quite right. I remember people saying the vote's being done in pencil. The vote's always done in pencil. They always provide pencils, and we have a very honest and robust electoral system. Would there have been conspiracy theories had it gone the other way? Yes, but I think they'd have been pretty fringe. I think the difficulty would have been that the EU that most people wanted to be a member of didn't exist then and was even less likely to exist in future, that the union of member states to act collaboratively where necessary but to act as states where they felt like it or where it was more convenient and sensible had long since gone, and that actually, you're quite right to mention Delors and the Maastricht Treaty, followed by Lisbon, led to an EU with which we weren't happy. And the EU that most people wanted wasn't actually on offer. So we were going to remain constantly unhappy with some things that were happening. So whether this was the delay on the rollout of the COVID vaccine because we were tied into the European Medicines Agency, whether it was the response to Ukraine, which would have been completely different if we'd been bound in by sincere cooperation, would probably never have happened. Putin would probably have succeeded had we been a member of the European Union. Whether it's the $2 trillion we've already talked about, bailout for COVID, all these things would have been problems for the UK that we would not have been able to stop as an individual member state.
Let me go back to the pencils, which you dismiss, I think rightly, as a fringe phenomena. One thing that you can't dismiss as a fringe phenomena, really, that was killed off by the Brexit vote was Nigel Farage. And until the Brexit vote, Nigel Farage had been, certainly in European elections, a phenomenon and was a major part of the political scene. He's polling, anywhere between 10 and 20%, depending upon where you are at the time. He's sort of a thorn in the side of the Conservative Party. He's certainly a vehicle for massive public dissatisfaction. And in the wake of a Remain vote, he'd still be there. He'd still be there now, would he not, for better or worse?
Oh, he might be Prime Minister. And I'm not joking that if you look at the success of the SNP once they'd lost the referendum, you may have found that lots of people decided to vote for UKIP, led by Nigel Farage, that they would have won seats in Parliament, particularly the Red Wall seats that came through to the Conservatives under Boris Johnson in 2019, because that would have been the only outlet remaining for their Euroscepticism. And to have a party that you thought was always on your side, always batting for Britain against the European bureaucracy, particularly when you discovered you couldn't leave it. So there would have been a logic in voters putting their trust in UKIP in those circumstances.
Let's hold that thought and think about the effect on the Conservative Party because, and here is a sometimes forgotten fact, David Cameron had promised to go. He promised to go before the EU referendum. He promised to go in an interview, if I remember rightly, with James Lansdale of the BBC shortly before the 2015 election. So in this imaginary world, Remain wins. Nigel Farage is still there. David Cameron goes as a leadership election. Lots, perhaps not the majority, but lots of Conservative MPs are unhappy with the referendum outcome. Certainly the activists are. There's a leadership election. Who becomes the Conservative leader?
Well, oddly, I think probably Boris Johnson.
Quite. I mean, surely you have a leadership election with perhaps George Osborne, maybe Theresa May, but surely there's only one likely winner. it's Boris Johnson who's asked what he thinks about a second referendum, and probably, you know, you forgive my very bad impersonation of Boris Johnson. He probably says something like, "Well, I can see this very good case. Lots of people are extremely so I have to think about this very seriously. And you know, we're going to have to look at this as a very live possibility." And since he's more pro-referendum, a second referendum, than any of the other candidates, he presumably walks the leadership and is then fighting Jeremy Corbyn in 2020 on the possibility of another Brexit referendum.
It all gets very complicated because would he have got the votes to get through the MP round to get to the members? The Tory party establishment would all have been backing George Osborne. They may have had enough MPs to be able to make sure that the number two candidate was, say, Theresa May, and that Boris never got through. At which point, you have not only a UKIP that is popular because of what Nigel managed to do in the referendum, but you've also got Boris, who seems to be deliberately kept back. So I think the consequences of the Tory party could have been potentially very difficult.
So we could argue this back and forth, because I think when Tory MPs divided on Brexit, my memory is, though some of the readers may correct me, it ended up by being about 60-40, 60 remain, 40.
So there is a very
solid Leave vote. But anyway, who knows? My scenario could be correct. Your scenario could be correct. But it all leads to the same conclusion, which is the idea that a Remain win in 2016 would have settled Brexit is, I'm afraid, whether you're a Remainer or a Leaver, a complete illusion. It would have gone on and on and on. And at least this way, it is settled one way or the other.
Yes, I think that's true, that it has settled it. People like me would have been very keen to respect the result of the referendum. I always thought that was the right thing to do. I'd intended, had the referendum gone the other way, to stop talking about this subject and metaphorically go to a Trappist monastery, because I think if you take part in a democratic operation and you lose, you should accept the result. And I don't think a second referendum would have been the right thing to do. But I can see the case you're making for why it wouldn't have been impossible and why the issue would have remained at the forefront of politics. And that would certainly have been true, because if you'd seen that 48% didn't even want to belong, the validity of new laws coming from Brussels that had got through on qualified majority vote would have been extremely limited.
But all that having been said, and you know, you can take a constitutional view one way or the other, I think it's certainly true that had the referendum gone the other way, the Brexit issue would not have been settled for the time being, which it has been. Nonetheless, it is the case, isn't it, that so far there's no proven economic advantage, and the effect of having trade barriers with one of our largest export markets has kicked in.
Well, I think there are some obvious advantages already. I mean, the £191 billion that I mentioned that we don't have a liability for is pretty significant. The gene editing bill is completing its passage through Parliament, which will be very important for agriculture in the UK, in which the EU is not following. The financial services bill that is going through Parliament at the moment will ensure that the City of London remains competitive. So there are some very important economic things happening. Before, I remind you, of course, that our economy opened up first out of COVID because we'd got the vaccine going sooner. And that was worth billions of pounds to the UK economy. So I would argue that, yes, there have already been significant economic benefits.
I'm not disputing there haven't been economic benefits. What I'm arguing or asking you is whether it's true that there's any independent study anywhere that says that net, so far, we are better off as a result of Brexit.
People have come up with their views of Brexit, but most people have accepted that it's very unclear as to what the picture is because of COVID, that it's very hard to say, considering we legally left just about a week before COVID hit, that everything that happened since has been either COVID or Brexit.
So I appreciate one can't disaggregate COVID and Ukraine from the noise. It's like trying to pick out a tune on a piano when a brass band is raging. All the same, it is a fact that, you know, practically every independent study that I could find, I've not found one to the contrary, argues that so far Brexit's a net loser. But let's not dwell...
But they're not taking into account these very large benefits. I haven't seen a study that said how much we save by opening the economy up early from COVID because we've left the European Union. I haven't seen a study that has shown the benefit to the global economy by not allowing Russia to win in Ukraine, which the EU would have been all set to do. I haven't seen a study that has included the £191 billion that we're not liable for. So it depends with all these studies on the information you put into them. And if you leave out the key information, of course you don't come to a rounded conclusion.
In which case, sort of penultimately, I suppose, why... It's certainly my impression before the anniversary, it's not necessarily afterwards. I felt that the collective Leave movement, if that's the right term of it, really wasn't very cheerful about the anniversary. I mean, there were not lots of people out banging drums and blowing bugles and waving flags. And the general mood among Eurosceptics seems somewhat muted. You disagree with that?
Well, I think we're very British. We're not frightful show-offs, you know. We're not like some other countries, which are always blowing their own trumpet. We just get on quietly with things. We keep calm and we carry on. Isn't that the British way?
All right, that's your version of it. Let me kind of put a different view to you. The different view would be that if you want to vote for Brexit for self-government and the great Lord Ashcroft 14,000-person poll on the... morning after, found that was the main reason why people left. It's why I voted for it primarily. It's why you did. So be it. If you want control over migration, that's done. But an argument would be that there was a tension at the heart of the economic debate among Brexiteers. That on the one hand, you had a group of very articulate, very well-connected liberal Brexiteers who can be found knocking around the free market institutes and conservative publications who wanted lower tax, less regulation, a smaller state, Singapore on sea, and all that. That was their view. On the other hand, most of those who voted for Brexit were older people from the provinces, and they might not be opposed to this vision of a radically reformed Britain, but it would mean an enormous shake-up to their pensions and healthcare that they don't want. And these two different economic visions have somehow cancelled each other out, and neither group is thrilled about the economic result.
Look, I don't deny that there are some Brexiteers who are free marketeers and some who are protectionists. I wouldn't quite put it the way you do, because I think the free market route pays for the pensions and the healthcare that the second group wants. I wouldn't make that particular division. But all the things I'm talking about, the bills currently through Parliament, the retained EU law bill, the repeal of thousands of EU regulations, that is all about the free market. The trade deals that we're doing and that we can do is all about opening up our market. That doesn't happen overnight, of course not, but we are moving in that direction. And these benefits are really fundamentally important. And we have to be very sensible. We have to be very aware of the protectionist argument, which is very seductive, particularly as the EU has behaved in a protectionist way towards us. And there are people who say, well, we should retaliate and make it harder for the EU to export to us, which would do nothing other than make our economy worse and would make people poorer and their choice of goods lower. So we must avoid those siren voices. But you're quite right, there is a free market protectionist tension, and the free marketeers have to make their argument and win the day on this.
That's how it must be in a democracy. I mean, just finally, closing the conversation altogether, it's impossible not to touch on it. The Northern Ireland Protocol, I mean, where do you think we are on the protocol? Is, you know, creation of Boris Johnson's deal? He and those of you who voted for it were never entirely happy with it. There's now the sort of prospect of a deal being done that might not address the DUP's concerns and get them back into government. It might not deal with the issue of the European courts and address the ERG's concerns. Where do you think we are on all that?
Well, there were, I think, three saving graces of the Northern Ireland Protocol. One is it was subordinate to the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. Two, it contained Article 16, so that if it wasn't working, it could be abrogated. And three, it was meant to be changed anyway by the parties to have a fluid system for the exchange of goods. It was never intended to be permanent. That's why people like me were willing to vote for it when it came before Parliament. There seems to me to be no point in agreeing a deal that does not restore power sharing, but that must be the objective. If it doesn't achieve that objective, I don't understand why the government is spending political capital on something that won't ultimately succeed. And there does seem to me to be a much simpler route, which is the bill before Parliament at the moment, which ensures that goods can go freely between GB and Northern Ireland. And the 7 points set out by the DUP, I think, are not only perfectly reasonable, but if I've understood it correctly, they have taken from statements made by the government as to what the government's policy is. So they've actually just quoted back the government what the government intends to do. So I hope the government will meet the DUP's concerns and go about it in that way, rather than thinking that a deal that satisfies nobody is going to be a lasting solution.
How big a risk is getting it wrong to Rishi Sunak? I mean, after all, he knows perfectly well that he wasn't elected in the summer. He's come in without a mandate of his own from the voters, doesn't have a mandate, if that's the right way of putting it, from party members. He's so far handled the parliamentary party very carefully. When he's threatened with revolt, for example, over planning, he tends to give way. His five priorities don't name Brexit. He's been unwilling to be distracted from them. Why is he galloping off on this quest that risks bringing down on his head the wrath of the DUP, the ERG, Liz Truss, and then finally lurking in the wings, Boris Johnson, with all the resonance that he has within the media and within certain sections of the party?
Well, Boris Johnson, of course, had a mandate. And his solution was the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, which is before Parliament at the moment. It's waiting for its report straight in the House of Lords. That is the answer to this conundrum, and it has the backing of the person who had a mandate from the British voters. And I think that's quite important. I don't know. I don't know why so much political capital has been spent on something without getting the DUP and the ERG on side first. It's quite surprising because this is very similar to what happened with Theresa May. So a story would appear in the Times and Downing Street would say, no, this isn't quite right. This isn't at all right. And then a week or two would go by and it would turn out to be completely right. And they would hope that people would just conveniently fall in behind the announced policy. And life doesn't work like that. It's important to get support for it first before you finalise the details. And that doesn't seem to have been done here. I think from the Prime Minister's point of view, your article had it spot on. The easiest thing for him to do is to kick the can down the road rather than either to have the big row with the European Union and pass the bill, which I think would be the right thing to do. I think it would solve the problem, but I can see why the Prime Minister is reluctant to do that. Or appear to give in to pressure from the EU to give them what they want. I think if you view those as Scylla and Charybdis, and kicking the can down the road is going through the middle with a few sailors being plucked off and eaten by Scylla, if I remember rightly, he would be better kicking the can through the middle of Scylla and Charybdis.
Well, one cabinet minister of whom I asked the same question simply sent me a text by way of reply that said, ours not to reason why, said this cabinet minister, ours but to do or die. And then there was a pause. And then 5 minutes later, back came another one that said, lead kindly light amidst the encircling gloom, lead thou me on. And on that note, which is so true for so many things, we will end this Mogcast. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much with two excellent quotations. Thank you.
The Mogcast, a fortnightly conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg about the topics of the day.